весь советский народ с чувством великого гнева и глубочайшего...
Лишение социальной защиты, расстрел Черновского Николая Францевича.
Никакой пощады врагам! Расстрелять...
Этой страстистой, трижды проклятой банде...
Я всецело предаю себя.
Приговор окончательный и обжалованию не подлежит.
The charges are often ludicrous, the evidence flimsy, the case is weak, and the media spotlight bright. But the outcome is nevertheless rarely in doubt. Sensational trials with clear political overtones are the trend of the moment in Russia. Last year's big case, of course, involved members of the feminist punk rock collective Pussy Riot, tried and convicted of hooliganism incited by religious hatred. This year, it's the scores of protesters who were arrested after gathering on Bolotnaya Square on the eve of Vladimir Putin's inauguration, and who are accused of organizing mass unrest, in some cases at the behest of foreign governments. And it's also the trial of anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny, accused of stealing 16 million rubles from a state-owned timber company. The defendants are different, but they have one thing in common. They've all crossed the Kremlin one way or another. And the trials are clearly aimed at silencing dissent. The show trial returns to Russia. What are the goals and what are the risks for the Kremlin? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Kirill Coburn is off this week. But on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Brian.
And joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and the author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean. It's been a while, and it's good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
Well, let's get rolling. This week, Alexei Navalny's trial opened in the Leninsky District Court in Kirov, and as I've said before, names don't get much more old Bolshevik than that. On Thursday, there was a verdict in the latest of the Bolotnaya cases when Konstantin Lebedev pled guilty to organizing mass disorder and was sentenced to 30 months in prison. Lebedev, you'll remember, is accused of conspiring with Left Front leader Sergei Udaltsov, activist Leonid Razvozhayev, and Georgian politician Givi Targamadze to organize violent demonstrations on May 6th of last year. Udaltsov is under house arrest. Razvozhayev has been kidnapped in Ukraine and is in custody. Lebedev has agreed to testify against both of them, so it seems the confessions are even about to come. Sean, let's start with you. I refer to these cases as show trials in my opening, and I'm sure somebody's going to accuse me of hyperbole out there for invoking that Stalin-era term. And while this gives me the opportunity to write a sexy headline, and it's an opportunity I'm going to shamelessly exploit, today's situation certainly differs from the Stalinist show trials in the 1930s in many obvious ways. I mean, nobody's getting shot at this point. But I do see similarities, specifically in the goals of these trials. Sean, you're the historian, and unlike Kirill, you actually enjoy historical parallels. Am I being fair calling these show trials?
Well, I do like historical parallels, but let me be the first to say that you're engaging in hyperbole.
It's nice to have some disagreement on the podcast for a change.
It depends on what you mean by a show trial. Now, if you mean kind of trumped up cases as political revenge to squash dissent, fabricated evidence, forced confessions, if you limit to show trial to that, then also the idea that it's supposed to send the population a certain message.
That's where I think it's – that's what I'm after there.
Yeah, and I think this is worth debating, of course, what that message is and what portion of the population is being sent to. But I think that the show trials of the Soviet period and the Stalin era in general have a lot of differences. I mean, one obvious fact is that the big show trials in the 1930s during the terror include the trials of insiders.
Exactly.
I mean, these are top Bolsheviks, people like Nikolai Bukharin, who were true believers. And if you read something like Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon, he gets into the psychology of why these top Bolsheviks would play along with the whole thing and confess. And that is a key difference, I think, the scriptedness of the Stalinist show trials, not only on the prosecution's part, but on the defense. I do think it's worth thinking about the aspect of the show. And with today's trials, with the Navalny trial, the Pussy Riot trial, and we'll see what happens when if and when Udaltsov is brought into the courtroom, the show is actually on both sides. And I would actually say that the defense has the bigger show platform. I mean, we saw 2 days ago Alexei Navalny getting up in court and giving this speech and directly pointing to the political intent of his trial as a point of revenge against him. I think this is incredibly important that the if we want to speak of it as a show trial, that both the defense is making a show of it. And you see this being broadcast on various opposition websites. You see opposition newspapers like Novaya Gazeta doing in-time transcripts of the trial. This is a departure from, say, the 1930s, where the media, of course, was closed, and all of the transcript publication was on the part of the state. It seems to me that, and I was looking at a report by NTV of Navalny's trial, it's actually really downplaying some of the gesticulations that you would see in a Stalinist trial, you know, Vyshinsky getting up and saying how these dogs should be shot, how they're enemies amongst us. The histrionics perhaps is more on the defense side in these current trials. So I do think it's interesting to think about it as a show trial, but maybe not in the terms of a Stalinist era show trial, because here the defense isn't necessarily playing its role. The last point, the confession. Stalinist show trials are rooted in the history of Bolshevik agitation trials, and also morality plays in trials of the late 19th century that were supposed to give the population, they had an educative aspect to them. And important to that education was the confession. Now, we do, of course, have Konstantin Lebedev giving a confession, but the point of Stalinist show trials and Bolshevik agitation trials in general was the defendant getting up and giving a full confession and embracing his or her guilt, thereby sending a signal to the population at large. I seriously doubt that we'll get this kind of mea culpa on the part of the defense in embracing their guilt. I mean, you even had Bukharin doing this in a strange way during his trial in 1938. So I think that thinking about it as a show trial, but not necessarily as a Stalinist echo, is certainly worth thinking about.
You've raised a lot of great points there. On the insiders, you anticipated me. I wanted to get to that if this is ever going to turn on insiders. But I think what you really said there that resonated with me is that it's a show trial on both sides. And if you watched Navalny going to his trial, it was practically a whistle-stop tour on that train from Moscow to Kirov, and he was getting out at every stop greeting bunches of supporters who had gathered to meet his train. You certainly wouldn't have seen that in the Soviet period.
No, but may I add something? You would see that in the late 19th century. Mm. So Russian revolutionaries of the 19th century also used the trial platform as a means to denounce the Tsarist government. So here, the trials of revolutionaries and from the 1880s on might be a better thing to think about in terms of how this trial plays out as a historical parallel of sorts.
If your parallel plays out, then this bodes very well for Mr. Navalny then, actually, if you push the parallel a little bit, yeah? Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely would agree that the problem with using terms like show trial, it sort of leads us into the realms of, you know, how far is Putinism like Stalinism without the mass murder? That is as pointless as talking about Nazism without the nastiness. You know, mass murder was central to Stalinism. Putin is not a Stalin. But nonetheless, I mean, I would definitely agree that there are key differences, particularly in terms of the trajectory leading to confession that was always a sort of part of the script of the show trial. Sean's absolutely right on that. What I would want to do is just put it into that slightly wider context, though. The whole thing about the show trial, and in a way what I think one of the key things about these current trials, is precisely that it's public. And in that respect, I would link it into things like Putin's record-breaking Q&A session that he had yesterday, or the televised upbraiding of officials that is still such a sort of trademark of the Putin's regime. It's an attempt to basically sort of create a public spectacle in place of public participation, and in the process legitimate the private politics that is actually going on within the system. So really, it's a way of simply, rather than just simply saying, you know, we are a closed deep state elite and we're going to run the country and you just knuckle down and do what you're told. It's that attempt to kind of, you know, almost in the same sort of way as a game show, it's an attempt to actually involve the public. And in the process, you hope, bring the public along with what the central state elite wants to do. So, yeah, very, very different circumstances. Navalny is not going to get a bullet in the back of the head, I'm glad to say. And indeed, he can indeed sort of play the show for his own advantage. That's entirely true. But I do think the similarity is, again, this attempt to use, back to dramaturgy really, a public spectacle as a way of neutralizing and co-opting public opinion.
But in the process, and in these trials, the Kremlin seems to be losing the plot. This is going back to Sean's point about that the show trial in the digital age is basically a PR opportunity for the defendants. The Kremlin's losing control of the narrative, and they're losing control of the plot. And what I wanted to do is go through, I guess, the three big show trials. I mean, Pussy Riot, I guess, was a dress rehearsal for Bolotnaya and Navalny. But what was the Kremlin trying? What message was the Kremlin trying to send to the public in each of these trials? And what are the risks involved? And what are they? What are they? What did they get in the Pussy Riot case? And what do they appear to be getting in the Bolotnaya and in the Navalny case? Sean, you want to tackle that?
Yeah, I think that the Mark's point about the public spectacle is really important because I think one minimal goal and Stalinist show trials or Soviet show trials were part of this too, and that's to paint those on trial as other, that they are not part of our community, and they need to be pushed outside. And here these trials, I think, played on the general morals of the population, right? The Pussy Riot trial played on Russian conservatism and orthodoxy and, of course, the women's role in society. I think perhaps the Bolotnaya case might play on the public's fear of instability and, of course, the idea that Russia is surrounded by enemies and we have external and internal enemies. And Navalny's case, I think it's also to discredit him as just another politician, right? I think here they're really playing on the public's skepticism and apathy towards politicians in general. To paint, here is this guy, he's not as principled as he says, he's really just as corrupt as all the rest of us are, in a way, right? And whether the charges are ludicrous and whether it's they can't prove them, it still places that doubt in people's minds, right? They may be losing the narrative and they're not controlling the script, but they can still count on people perhaps saying, well, if this Navalny guy, if there wasn't something wrong with him, why did he fall into trouble? Good people, bad things don't happen to good people, because the realization that bad things happen to good people is a really difficult one for people of the general public to come to terms with.
And what are the risks in each of these cases? Do you see risks and pitfalls?
I see short-term risks. I don't really see long-term risks. I mean, if anything, the Khodorkovsky trial showed that. I mean, you can have short-term risks. The international media will be up in arms. A bunch of human rights organizations will come out with their blanket denunciations. But in the general scheme of things, it's not really going to rock any kind of international relations. And the general public in Russia isn't going to react strongly to putting these people in prison.
Well, I think the Khodorkovsky analogy is interesting. And, Mark, we discussed this in the podcast a few weeks back or a couple of weeks back. But 2013 is not 2003. And I guess I see some risks here. The Bolotnaya case, I see some clear risks. I think that might be the riskiest of the bunch for them because this one is the one actually that gave me the idea to engage in hyperbole and bring up the ghost of Stalin, not because people are getting shot or anything, but because of the sweep of it, because scores of people who just happened to, in a lot of cases, were in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm not talking about your Udaltsovs or your Lebedevs or your Razvajaevs, but a lot of people are just ordinary students that were got swept up in this whole thing, wrong place, wrong time, wrong associations, guilt by association, and each and every one of these people have parents, or in some cases children, and brothers and sisters and friends, and they have friends, and so on and so on and so on, and I think this is the case that really might turn off Middle Russia, if you will, to use the old Middle America phrase, you know, the analogy, to the regime. I think there's a big risk there. Pussy Riot exposed, you're right, they're playing to conservatism, they're playing to orthodoxy, they're playing to women's role in society. But guess what? They also alienated and showed me that there's a chunk of Russian society, it's not a majority yet, but it's there and it's growing and it's reaching critical mass, that has very different opinions about these things. It's the more modern cosmopolitan side of society. It exposed the cleavages in Russian society. The Navalny trial, I mean, as Mark and I discussed a couple of weeks ago, the case is so weak. Navalny is such a tough nut to crack because he is such a skilled PR guy. And he's a very likable figure, in my opinion, who's very good at exploiting opportunities like this. So I think there are short and long term risks in each and every one of these. I'm not sure, and I'm curious to see. You may turn out to be right, but I don't think this is going to follow the Hodorkovsky template, because 2013 is not 2003. And Navalny's is certainly no Hodorkovsky, and the Bologna case and the Pussy Riot for different reasons. Mark, what's your two cents here?
Yeah, I think it's probably worth disaggregating the three, because in a way, I think while we inevitably lump the three trials together, they're each actually playing for a different purpose, and therefore each has a different potential risk. I think it's worth it if you start with Navalny. Let's just point one thing out. I mean, we see the Navalny footage because A, we're in the West, and B, we're wonks, and therefore we go out and do so. It's worth having a certain caution about how far the sort of your average Russian really is getting a decent picture. I mean, actually, although it's still very sort of early days or whatever, but the kind of polling data we've seen so far suggests that Navalny is better known than before, but less liked. Which actually suggests that although, of course, the Kremlin has lost a lot of its dramaturgical touch, nonetheless, there's a limit to how much a smiling face and fancy footwork will do when actually it's the other side that gets to edit and decide quite what goes on to sort of national television. But anyway, you know, we wait and see. I mean, certainly I wouldn't be ruling Navalny out at this stage yet. But if we look at the three, Navalny is clearly personally targeted. I mean, the Navalny trial is about Navalny. There's no question about that. It's not as if there's anyone else it's a warning to or anything like that. It's they've identified that he is the one guy who they feel really is a threat, and therefore somehow they need to take him out. And it's probably that this is just simply the prelude to a suspended sentence that will at least rule him out of actually standing for elected office. And therefore the risks are very much, I think, associated with Navalny. If the West, for example, eventually decides that Navalny is important, then there might be risks related to that. Navalny might be given the opportunity to precisely sort of turn himself into a public figure. You know, we'll wait and see. PR, Pussy Riot was terribly different. Pussy Riot wasn't really about the Pussy Riot singers at all. They were entirely trivial and irrelevant in this respect. It was actually precisely about, well, to whom was this pandering? And again, it was the Russian Orthodox Church, a certain sort of rump support and so forth. So, I mean, in that respect, the thing about the Pussy Riot case is that it alienated people who were already alienated from the state. It's not actually as if you had your sort of up to now fervently pro-Kremlin figures out in Tambov or whatever, who had thought, well, you know, I was all behind Putin, but my God, look the way he's dealing with, you know, an anti-Christian punkettes in the church. Now I'm a radical all the way. But going on to Bolotnaya, and I think I agree with you that actually Bolotnaya is in some ways the most generally significant, even if it's also the lowest profile, at the moment, at least, of all these court cases. Because it is precisely trying to target opposition as a whole rather than a specific individual or whatever. And yeah, most of the people involved are not important in the sort of the grand scheme of things. They're obviously important as human beings. And that does carry with it, I think, a much greater wild card factor. Because as you say, there's a lot of individuals concerned, and each has their own networks and so forth. Networks of people around them who actually will no doubt span people who are predisposed to opposition and people who aren't. The thing about the sort of the Navalny and the Pussy Riot cases is in a way their constituency is already of the oppositionists. Balot and I am, because all of a sudden there's the, you know, why is my niece being arrested? Why is my brother-in-law being arrested? Has the chance to actually reach a wider society. And okay, it's still going to be a very small fraction, but it does have that opportunity to become symbolic of a regime that is intolerant, clumsy, and frankly using the state machine just against people who just want to protest. Because let's be honest, despite, you know, scrimmages in the margins, Bolotnaya was a large, peaceful mass protest of the sort that, frankly, a democratic society, as Russia claims to be, ought to permit.
And a lot of the skirmishes in the margins, by the accounts of a lot of neutral observers, were provoked by the police, in fact, which makes you wonder if this was all planned in advance to create a big case out of this. I don't know if that's the case or not. Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I think the Bolotnaya case, though, you know, the one thing that I think that has overridden the narrative of it as a peaceful protest is that the majority of people don't remember it, at least in the media narrative, as a peaceful protest. The violence has completely rewritten that narrative. And I think that, yeah, this trial could involve a bunch of networks of people who friends and brothers and sisters and uncles that see their loved ones being put on trial. But I think in the mass consciousness, I think the violence completely taints their legitimacy. Mm-hmm. If this has any resonance, and this idea comes from the fact of what I've seen in Western protests in the United States, when there's violence, the violence completely overshadows the idea that this was a peaceful protest with good intentions. And I think because of that, the fact that Bolotnaya involved these skirmishes with the police, I don't think that this will curry much sympathy.
I agree with you, and I'll wait and see. I mean, I think you very well could be right there. One thing the Kremlin did manage to accomplish with the Bolotnaya case already is to steal the Bolotnaya brand. Because remember, before May 6th of last year, or I'd say between December of 2011 and May 6th of last year, when you said Bolotnaya, when I said Bolotnaya, what'd you think of? Well, you thought of that mass protest with the clever signs that was right in the wake of the Duma election. And this was like, oh, my God, the biggest demonstration in Moscow since the 90s. And look at these clever, middle class, well-dressed people with their funny signs and their iPads. Well, then Bolotnaya now in the public imagination invokes these images of violence on May 6, 2012. So they really did a bit of rebranding there that was actually pretty effective. As I was listening to you both, I came and was thinking of what, you know, the meta goals the Kremlin may have been trying. And I don't know if I can get inside their heads there. But if you look at these three cases, the Pussy Riot case in a lot of ways seems to be aimed at the creative class. Because what is Pussy Riot but exemplars of this internet, this brazen internet savvy hip young crowd that formed a lot of the backbone of the protest. Bolotnaya was against people who will take to the street, because the randomness which people are getting rounded up and tied up into this is really stunning. And so it's telling you go to a protest, yeah, you might get home all right, but we might round you up a week from now and charge you with something crazy, and there ain't a damn thing you can do about it. The Navalny case, this is the first, I think, the first opposition figure that represents individually a viable threat to the current authority. So, yeah, Mark, you're right. They want to take him out as somebody that can legitimately run for election. So there's kind of almost a hierarchy of things they're going after here. The whole class, the people that are going to take to the streets, and I guess their titular leader, you know, in that order, I think. Before we move on to the second half, where we're going to stick with this theme but focus on why Putin felt the need to address it, I wanted to go after one thing here. And Sean, you touched on in the beginning, one of the key differences between this and the original show trials is that the original show trials was when they went after insiders. Now, there's been an anti-corruption or something that passes for an anti-corruption campaign going on since Putin came back to the Kremlin. Serdyukov already had to resign as defense minister over a procurement scandal. Do you see this kind of thing, whatever you want to call it, begin to be turned around against insiders as well? Mark, I guess I'll go to you.
Yeah, I think the chances of show trials involving members of the elite at the moment are pretty minimal. I think for several reasons. One is that, again, Stalin had a very, very different relationship with the elite than Putin. The point of the show trials going after members of the inner circle was precisely because Stalin was out to break the elite as having any potential to resist him. Putin is not, I think, willing or able to try and do that, much as he'd like to sort of slightly rebalance the relationship between himself and the elite. We're seeing it with the de-offshoring and everything else. But secondly, again, it's a question of control of the script. If you are going to get, I mean, even let's face it, Serdyukov, I think one of the reasons why he is not currently being sort of hauled up on trial and so forth, despite the fact that there, at one point there were indications that he might be, is because he, like any other members of the elite, knows where a lot of dead bodies are buried, usually metaphorically. And therefore, in that respect, given that they can't completely, we can't completely control access, we can't completely control the outcomes. And part of the reason for the whole sort of confession dynamic of the original show trials was precisely because there was an ideological component to the elite. They all ultimately believed in something. The current Kremlin elite believe in their own self-interest. And therefore, let's be honest, you know, their temptation would be either to try and blackmail the state by saying, if you put me on trial, who knows what I'm going to say, or just simply try and bring the whole fabric, you know, the whole structure down in Samsonian style. So I think, you know, for these reasons, the elite is actually much stronger now than it was under Stalin. And the aim is very different. Stalin, frankly, he had things like collectivization to destroy potential mass resistance. Show trials was specifically a weapon against elite enemies. At the moment, essentially, Putin is acting with the elite and trying to sort of put down a potentially mass opposition movement.
And if I can believe what I read in the Russian press, Sergei Ivanov, Dmitry Rogozin, and Chemezov all wanted to have Serdyukov in the dock, but Putin apparently won't let it happen. That's if I can believe what I'm reading in the media. Sean, what do you think? You agree with that? The insiders are pretty much safe from this spectacle for the time being?
Yeah, and I think they are. I think you'll get some kind of a low-level middle management, but any type insiders, I seriously doubt it. For one reason, as you've talked about on the podcast many times, and as we know from the Russian press, the cracks in the elite are quite widespread in the top elite. A show trial of one figure, and here one can make a similar Stalin's parallel, will essentially has the potential of creating a wider civil war within the elite. Because once one goes up and starts confessing, and here I'm jumping on what Mark said, everyone else might start outing everyone else. And this is something that Stalin did want to break the backs of the elite, but he eventually had to pull back because the party began to self-destruct, because everybody started going after everybody else. And I think Putin, by going after top figures, he runs the risk of a more public fracturing and a much, much more thorough fracturing of the elite or self-destruction elite, which he can't really afford.
Right. Okay, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion about show trials and ask why, despite my hyperbole, Putin, during his annual Q&A session with the public, felt compelled to insist that Stalinism is not on its way back in Russia. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Я не считаю, что здесь есть какие-то элементы сталинизма. I don't think there are any elements of Stalinism here. Stalinism is associated with a personality cult and massive violations of the law, with repressions and labor camps. There is nothing like that in Russia right now, and I hope there will never be. Our society is simply different now, and it will never allow that. But this doesn't mean that we should not have order and discipline.
Well, Shakespeare may say the lady doth protest too much. That, of course, was Vladimir Putin in his annual question-and-answer session with carefully screened ordinary citizens, insisting that Russia is not going Stalinist. Now, it's a given that no question gets through. And that was a question from Venediktov, the Echo Moskvy editor-in-chief. Putin's answer was answering a question by Venediktov there. Now, it's a given that these questions are screened and that Putin knew this was coming. He had his answer prepared. And so it gets into this whole scripted nature of all this. So if this is the case, why would Putin's handlers want to let that through? Why would they feel compelled that they must address this issue now, Mark?
There's an interesting defensiveness at work. I mean, I think it's fair to say that one of many ways in which Putin is unlike Kirill is that he does like historical parallels.
But so Putin is like Sean, is what you're saying.
It's been said many a time. He's very much tried to craft his own historical parallels. You know, at different times, he's either paralleled himself or allowed himself to be paralleled to figures like Stolypin and Peter the Great and so forth. And therefore, I think, on the one hand, there is an irritation at the number of times in which the Stalinist parallel has been of late raised, and therefore almost a sense of wanting to kind of put the record straight. But secondly, and here I'm just speculating, but I think that one of the reasons for allowing this question through and sort of putting some weight on it and making it clear that, you know, although he's all behind order and discipline, nonetheless, that's a long way from Stalinism, is, I think, wanting to try and sort of emphasize the point that, in fact, Russians are in a far, far better situation now than they were then. Wanting to emphasize that actually that one can have a system which is based upon some substantial levels of order and discipline, but which is not, you know, murderous and sort of capricious in the Stalinist way. Now, that's just pure speculation. But, I mean, in some ways, this is actually sort of Putin saying he actually think things are much better than our more outspoken critics would admit. But I think more than anything else, I think it is precisely it comes down to the fact that he's always very jealous of his historical parallels. And wants to be able to control that particular aspect of the conversation.
So if I'm engaging in hyperbole, Putin is defensive about the hyperbole that myself and others are engaging, I guess we could say. Sean, what do you see there? What do you see happening with that?
I pretty much agree with what Mark said about Putin and historical parallels and this defensiveness. But my question is why people keep on asking about Stalinism. And this goes to my own kind of interest in the memory of Stalinism in contemporary Russia and the fact that society really has yet to get over the trauma of that period. I mean, here we're speaking of something that happened 70 years ago. Why not compare Putin to, I don't know, Andropov or the late Soviet period, where the state is going about neutralizing dissent is more comparable to that than, say, 1930s. I mean,
yeah,
1937,
I
mean, this is – Stalinism is so much more than even Putin has put forward. It really is its own animal. So I think that you know, I understand Putin wanting to differentiate himself and the fact that people keep on bringing it up. And trying to equate him with Stalinism. I mean, I just read it. There was an editorial in the Moscow Times today that basically used the show trial metaphor. But I think it's also worth asking why people keep on bringing up the Stalin question and why Russians have not, at least in my estimation, have not dealt with Stalinism in any real sense. Because when it comes down to it, Stalinism is not just Stalin. Stalinism is 4 million denunciations. Stalinism is people pointing fingers at their neighbors. Stalinism is mass mobilization of regular people against each other. And this deflection of trying to personalize the Stalinist regime and also connecting Putin personally to Stalinism, I think this is just a form of transference, of not actually dealing with the real trauma of that period in Russian memory.
Also, I would add, though, that by raising this issue in such a high profile event of his Q&A session with the public, which is nationally televised and widely watched, not just by geeks like us, but by ordinary Russians, Putin guaranteed that this parallel is going to be out there. It's going to continue to be out there. I mean, he guaranteed, by my count yesterday, that at least two major international news agencies, Western news agencies, led on this in their stories about the Q&A session. So it's interesting. He, by engaging in defensiveness and saying, well, it's not as bad as it was in the 30s, he just guaranteed that people are still going to continue keep talking about Putin and Stalin, which is very interesting. In the remaining few minutes we have, I just wanted to throw this one out there. Did anything else about Putin's Q&A session yesterday catch anybody's eye? I found him getting a little emotionally when he mentioned Berezovsky quite interesting. And of course, the exchange with Alexei Kudrin I found pretty interesting. What about you guys? Mark, go ahead.
I agree that the Kudrin exchange was interesting. I think it was also interesting that we actually had a mention of Shoigu, you know, as an up-and-coming figure. Again, very unusual to have a name being floated. And as you say, these things don't just simply sort of float out of the ether. These things tend to be sort of carefully planned and programmed, which makes me wonder if that was a trial balloon and a signal. That sort of wanting to check whether what kind of response there will be to having Shoigu's name out there. So I thought that was actually pretty significant as well.
That goes back to when we were discussing Shoigu as a potential successor a few weeks back. Sean, what about you? What did you see that was interesting?
Oh, I think the whole spectacle is fascinating to me. I mean, this you know, Putin taking on the role of the decider and the doer, the guy who solves problems. The whole aspect of all the media assembling and counting how many questions Russians gave, how long Putin talked, how he broke his last record. This whole exchange between leader and people, I think, is enough to the content for me doesn't even really matter. Mm. I mean, yeah, you have these kind of trial balloons, you have these signals, and you have these kind of funny exchanges, you know, calling Kudrin a slacker or things like this. I mean, the content is, but I think the whole kind of form is really fascinating, and I really wonder why, after suspending this last year and kind of signaling that they weren't going to do it anymore, or at least do it on a much smaller scale, why they went back to this kind of large performance. And what does that say about the state of things today?
I think it says they're living in the past, because this is a relic of a bygone era. I mean, a bygone era, if you can call, you know, whatever, 7-8 years ago, bygone era, I guess you can. But this fit with Putin 1.0 very well, and he used it very effectively. It looks kind of like a leisure suit or a mood ring now. You know, it's a little out of date, you know, but they keep doing it because I guess they just can't let go. Like I've said a billion times, Putin wants to party like it's 2007. And he keeps doing it. Another thing I noticed that I found very interesting is that, and when we talked about the big press conference a couple of months back, it was the same thing, is that they're letting more challenging questions through. I mean, Venediktov getting a question in there, the exchange with Kudrin. Okay, yeah, Kudrin's part of the broader elite, even though he's not in the government anymore. He and Putin are personally close, but he let Kudrin kind of go at him. That was pre-planned. There's no doubt about that. That wasn't spontaneous. In the past, it was like, you know, Ivan Ivanovich from Chelyabinsk asking Putin, why are you such a great leader? You know, and so this is another way that this has changed over time. And I guess I don't know what that says about the changing goals or needs of the Kremlin. For last word, either of you want to have anything to say about that? Mark, go ahead.
I would just say one thing. Exactly. I think what they're trying to do is to go back to what worked the first time round in the first Putin. But precisely, they're not quite so stupid as to think they can just simply just rerun, you know, put in an episode of reruns. They're trying to make it more of an interactive thing, more of a challenging thing, to show in some ways that Putin moves with the times, that Putin is a hep cat. But again, ultimately their idiom is always the same. You know, they know they need to try and show that Putin can handle opposition to himself and that he can master it. But the only way they can think of doing it is in the old style. So I think that, you know, this actually is quite a useful window into precisely what's going on within those people whose job it is to try and craft the Kremlin's message.
So they're carrying an iPhone, but they're wearing a mood ring and a leisure suit, I guess, to push my metaphor. Sean, any last word to you?
Yeah, I just wonder how this actually plays out in society at large. I mean, you know, we had, 4 hours and 57 minutes or 50-some minutes? I mean, who really – and it's broadcast prime time. I mean, who is going to sit there and watch this?
Just be happy you didn't have to cover it.
I think you're right. It is an echo of 2000, you know, the high point of Putin, but it's also an echo of these party congresses of the late Soviet period that you know, just kind of expectation that people are going to watch this when they're up against, you know, real entertainment. So it makes me think that in terms of, you know, yeah, it's a flashback to try to recapture Putin at his best. But at the same time, it's like, you know, a repackaged bad sequel to a movie that frankly shouldn't be produced anymore. What it says is that when it comes to PR, they have learned very, very little.
And they used to look so sharp. That's what's amazing. Well, I enjoy these things, and I do find them entertaining, but probably not for the reasons they would want people to find them entertaining. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for today, so we're going to wrap up. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galliotti, an expert in Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania has been Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia Blog. Thank you for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.